thank you for that introduction, and thanks to Bill Campbell for inviting me as a guest here. Title of my talk is Progressivism, Conservatism, and Woodrow Wilson. That progressivism is a subject of a meeting of the Philadelphia Society is to me rather remarkable. It's a sign of the growing realization in politics and in academia of the relevance of the progressive movement to the American political tradition. Now, it's certainly true that some have been on the case of the progressives for a long time. The wider recognition, however, that the progressives were instrumental to the development of statism in modern America, that the progressives were really the intellectual force that laid the groundwork for the New Deal and the rise of the administrative state. This is a more recent phenomenon and realization. One of the best things to me about the Philadelphia Society meetings is that they are the only occasions, of which I'm aware at least, where the different groups comprising the conservative movement gather together. And while I certainly don't want to disregard the important differences within the conservative movement, it is presumably the case that conservatives have in common a desire to conserve something, or in the face of today's administrative state, we might say to restore something about the political tradition in America, which is either threatened or has been lost in the wake of modern liberalism. And this is exactly where the relevance of progressivism comes in. Progressives are important precisely because one finds in the progressive movement the first sustained comprehensive critique of the original American political tradition, of the principles of limited constitutional government, and an argument for replacing them with the principles that would facilitate the progressive vision for an expansive administrative welfare state. Now, another great advantage of studying the progressive critique of the Constitution is that it was a self-conscious critique. That is to say, progressives knew that their vision for American government necessitated a repudiation of the American Constitution. It is no accident that significant portions of the writings of John Dewey, Herbert Croly, Woodrow Wilson, Frank Goodnow, among others, were devoted to explicating the principles of the Constitution and attacking them. And the clarity of progressive writings in this way provides far greater insight into the foundational thinking of modern liberalism than I think do the later, more political attempts to implement progressivism in the New Deal. This is why, to me anyways, Woodrow Wilson is of particular interest and importance. Now, in pointing to Wilson, I don't suggest that he was solely responsible for originating the progressive critique of the American political tradition, but Wilson's writings do provide an especially clear and early expression of the progressive vision of government that became so prominent in the latter part of the 19th century. And Wilson's specific ways of translating the general perspective of progressives into specific proposals for transforming national institutions, whether it be in the field of public administration, the presidency, reform of the party system, or elsewhere, later became very influential and I think in several cases remain influential today. Now, until relatively recently, counting Wilson as a progressive would have been met with some degree of debate. And this is because Wilson has been understood by some to be a conservative critic of progressivism. And this reputation comes partly from Wilson's role as a critic of Theodore Roosevelt's new nationalism in the 1912 presidential campaign. And partly it comes from the fact that the few works of Wilson that were commonly read didn't really provide the clearest insight into his long-held philosophy of politics. Now, while almost nobody familiar with Wilson's record as president would dispute the contention that he turned out to be a statist who did his part to advance the sharp expansion of the federal government in the 20th century, it is not uncommon to see the argument that Wilson was a late convert to progressive statism. With some important exceptions, many have suggested that Wilson was a kind of conservative, a Southerner who defended federalism and the prerogatives of states, who was suspicious of national power and the threat that it might pose to liberty. The policies of Wilson's presidency, which expanded national government and administration along the very lines that Roosevelt had called for in 1912, reflect in this context what one historian has claimed was Wilson's conversion to the new nationalism. Now, the main problem with the argument that Wilson converted from conservatism is that those making it ignore almost entirely Wilson's long and substantial body of work as an academic. As a professor of government, and Wilson was the first and only professional political scientist to become president of the United States, you can insert your own private joke there. Wilson wrote prolifically as a professor for over 20 years on the principles of politics, and these writings show quite unmistakably that he was a consistent statist and a consistently sharp critic of the American tradition of ordered liberty and limited constitutional government. Wilson held and expressed these views from his earliest days of writing about politics as a young academic and throughout the subsequent stages of his career in both academic and political leadership. As more of these writings have become available to us, as scholars have had a chance to rely upon them, as opposed to his later political speeches, where his hostility to the American political tradition was stated somewhat more cleverly, Wilson's importance as a leading progressive is becoming more and more apparent. In general, Wilson's political thought has at its core a conception of government that is in sharp contrast with the principles of the American Constitution. And this contrast becomes evident in the overall Hegelian framework within which Wilson placed the development of the U.S. Constitution. For Wilson, although America's Constitution had been appropriate for the circumstances of the founding, the constitutional order needed to move forward in order to adapt to the demands of a new age. And Wilson here was, in fact, one of the first to refer to the Constitution as a living document. Now, the historicist understanding of government was an important part of Wilson's political thinking from the earliest days of his writings about politics. In his 1889 textbook, The State, the very title of which, of course, ought to tell us something, Wilson wrote that government does now whatever experience permits or the times demand. And the argument that Wilson subsequently makes about the American Constitution is based upon this historical understanding of the state. He makes clear in the New Freedom Campaign of 1912, for example, he suggests there that speaking of the Constitution in the old sense is to speak of it from a Newtonian perspective. And Newtonian government, he explains, is mechanical in its forms, unchanging, unreflective of true constitutional government. Such, Wilson reasoned, was the Constitution of the founders. The founders, he said, failed to perceive, quote, that government is not a machine but a living thing. And for Wilson, any constitutional government must be organic, not mechanical. It falls, he wrote, under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. Government, he wrote, like any organism, is modified by its environment. And so the old, rigid constitutional structure of limited government had to be discarded because, Wilson wrote, no living thing can have its organs offset against each other as checks and live. The traditional roles of American institutions had to be changed if Wilson was, as he said, to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. Now, the fundamental premise of Wilson's writing on government is that there can be no principled limitation on the power of the state. The scope of state action, in other words, can only be what the current historical spirit of society calls for it to be. If the historical environment is jealous of state power, as it was during the time of the founding, then the scope of government will, of course, be limited accordingly. But once history moves forward into an era where the objective will of society calls for a greater role for state power over the individual, as Wilson asserted, of course, was the case during his own time, then the limits on the scope of government must be loosened accordingly. Now, this is a concept to which Wilson subscribed throughout his life, and I think it's nicely encapsulated in a short essay he wrote in 1887 titled Socialism and Democracy. Wilson's point in this essay about the relationship between socialism and his own theory of democracy is that there was little or no principal difference between the two. He begins the essay by defining socialism, suggesting that the doctrine of socialism embraces unfettered state power, which trumps any notion of individual liberty. It, quote, proposes that all idea of a limitation of public authority by individual rights be put out of view, and that no line can be drawn between public and private affairs which the state may not cross at will. Now, after laying out this clear definition of socialism, Wilson makes equally clear that he finds nothing wrong with it in principle. He contends that socialism is much closer to his idea of true democracy than is any notion of government which attempts to limit the power of the state by protecting a sphere of individual liberty. Socialism, Wilson explained, was simply the logical extension of genuine democratic theory. It gives all power to the people in their collective capacity to carry out their will through the exercise of governmental power, unlimited by any democratic idea like individual liberty. And he elaborates in this way. In fundamental theory, socialism and democracy are almost, if not quite, one and the same. They both rest at bottom upon the absolute right of the community to determine its own destiny and that of its members. Limits of wisdom and convenience to the public control there may be. Limits of principle there are, upon strict analysis, none. And Wilson goes on to explain that his only objection to socialism was a practical one, that he didn't believe that men had yet learned how to organize government so that it could efficiently handle all of the responsibilities that socialists wanted to give it. Now, I should mention here that Wilson devoted much of his academic work to improving the science of administration, to improving, in other words, the variability of modern democracies to handle the greater variety of tasks and responsibilities. Now, I want to turn to the 1912 campaign, where Wilson's New Freedom Program is often cast as a conservative defense of limited government against the overtly paternalistic New Nationalism program of Theodore Roosevelt. And I want to suggest instead that Wilson's New Freedom, while perhaps superficially more conservative in its rhetoric than the New Nationalism, nonetheless embraced ideas that were consistent with Wilson's statism and consistent with his rejection of the principles of the Constitution. It's the case in the 1912 campaign that Wilson was critical of the discretionary administrative power that Roosevelt proposed to grant to independent regulatory agencies. But it was not, of course, as if Wilson had long opposed empowering regulatory agencies. Wilson's record as governor of New Jersey 1911 and 1912 was explicit and bold in its endorsement of granting significant independent power to regulatory agencies. It was, in fact, a model for progressives around the country. This was a program that Wilson implemented just before his supposedly conservative campaign of 1912 and his subsequent alleged conversion to the progressive policies of the New Nationalists upon assuming the presidency. Furthermore, as anybody familiar here with the discipline of public administration would know, Wilson's famous essay from 1886 on the study of administration virtually founded that discipline. Its entire premise is that national administration had to be both powerful and independent, that administrators, because of their expertise, needed significant freedom, both from the influence of politics and from the constitutional limitations that might otherwise apply to exercises of state power. in the 1912 campaign itself, where Wilson criticized Roosevelt's new nationalism, where he criticized its call for expanding national administrative power, I would suggest that several practical matters are worth considering. First, Wilson's aim, quite naturally, was to win the election. And as evidence from his 1910 campaign for governor very amply shows, Wilson was willing to use means that might be contrary to his own long-held principles in order to win office. Once elected, he could go back to those long-held principles and put them into practice. Consider also Wilson's clear dependence in 1912 on the Bryan wing of the Democratic Party. It took 46 ballots for Wilson to win the party's nomination in 1912, and that occurred only after the intervention of Bryan in his favor. Central to Bryan's populism was a fear of national executive power and a deep distrust of business interests in the Northeast. By campaigning against Roosevelt's plan to maintain the business trust by bringing them into a regulatory relationship with the national government, Wilson certainly solidified his position with the Bryan Democrats, who were, after all, essential to his victory. Once elected, Wilson lost little time in backtracking from those expedient campaign positions that had not been grounded in his own long-held philosophy of politics. And of course, Wilson's early legislative program as president ended up embracing and putting into practice much of the new nationalist agenda, including the very expansion of national administration that he had criticized in the campaign. Finally, I want to address the assumption of many scholars that Wilson's political views were largely shaped by his Southern heritage. Certainly, this is of interest to many in the conservative movement. The so-called Southern view of Wilson sees him as a defender of states' rights, a stickler for federalism, whose fundamental approach to politics was a kind of limited government Jeffersonianism. Now, of all the claims that Wilson was some kind of a conservative, this is the most puzzling, because the evidence to the contrary is so overwhelming. For Wilson, the defeat of the South and its cause of states' rights in the Civil War marked a decisive stage, the decisive stage, in America's progress as a nation. And this is a consistent theme in his thought from his earliest writings and throughout his public life. Wilson believed that in order for America to become a truly modern democratic state, national unity was essential. The history of America, Wilson thought, was a history of our moving away from localism, sectionalism, and states' rights, and toward a future of unity as a national organism. The dominant theme of Wilson's history, division and reunion, was that the Civil War defeat of the South and its principles constituted the major step in our progress as a nation. In that book, Wilson characterizes the states' rights principles of the South as reactionary. He depicts the Southerners as the constitutional originalists. They stood, in other words, for the antiquated principles of limited government that had to be overcome by the more progressive and expansive view of federal power prominent in the North. So the North was on the side of progress, and the South was fighting against the direction of history, Wilson believed. Wilson wrote of that conflict, quote, "I think the North was wholly right then, and that the South paid the inevitable penalty for lagging behind the national development, stopping the normal growth of the national constitution." And even Wilson, as a young Southerner, celebrated the defeat of the reactionary constitutionalism of the South, explaining, quote, "Because I love the South, I rejoice at the failure of the Confederacy." Now, let me conclude my remarks by returning briefly to Wilson's, this question of Wilson's reputation as a conservative, because I want to say that Wilson did, with some justification, fancy himself a conservative in the Burkean sense. That is to say, Wilson at least shared Burke's antipathy for the place of abstract theory in politics. And Wilson employed this antipathy in attacking any principled discussion of liberty or rights. But Wilson profoundly misunderstood Burke. or at least understood him in only a very incomplete way. Wilson's admiration for Burke, of course, came out of his admiration for the British parliamentary system. And he admired the parliamentary system because it was the antithesis of America's separation of powers constitutionalism. Wilson thus adopted a very peculiar take on Burke's principles and turned them into an argument for statism. Wilson turned Burke, in other words, into Hegel. And Wilson saw no conflict between the organic Burkeanism that he claimed to admire and advocating a wholesale radical change in the American political order. In this respect, Wilson was every bit a progressive, and one who conservatives should have in mind when it comes to evaluating the modern state as a legacy of the progressive movement. Thank you.